Welcome to The Independent with Scott Atlas by The Independent Institute, my show that tries to bring a uniquely rational perspective to important issues facing society today. Today, I'm delighted to say my guest is Steve Hilton. Steve is an author, news commentator, entrepreneur, and policy expert. Steve was born in London to Hungarian parents who escaped communism. He graduated from Oxford University and then worked in politics and then in his own business. He was the director of strategy and a senior advisor for then UK Prime Minister David Cameron. After that, he began writing for Fox News and then had his own very popular show, The Next Revolution, which he hosted until 2023, where he was a proponent of what he called positive populism. Since then, he's increased his focus on California public policy, has an organization called Golden Together, a bipartisan think tank, and is rumored to be seeking, potentially, the governorship of California. We have a wide-ranging conversation about the role of the media, especially in the wake of the election, censorship, and his views on what happens next, both politically and as American media evolves. Thanks for joining us. Okay, Steve Hilton, welcome.
Fantastic to be with you. I've been wanting to do this. I keep seeing clips of this show everywhere. I think, why hasn't Scott asked me yet? And now you have, so I'm very happy.
Okay, well, now that's super nice of you, and I'm thrilled that you were able to squeeze me into your busy schedule. There's so many things to talk about, of course. And number one, let's talk about the election results. I can give you my very brief take. I was surprised.
Oh, really?
That's just the bottom line. I knew the polls. I knew the attitude of people. My world, I sort of overestimated the impact of the mainstream media, the propaganda, the Hitler analogy. What say you about this?
So I was only surprised at the scale and the speed, if I could put it like that. I was very, very sure that Trump would win. I really was. And because it just felt to me on the fundamentals, you know, people want change. That was very evident. And you look at Kamala Harris, I mean, she's a joke. I mean, a complete joke. And the more that the campaign went on, the more that was revealed. I mean, even I changed my opinion of her in the downward direction. I would, at the beginning of all of this, I would try and defend her to a certain extent. And because I don't know her, but I have met her. I met her once the first year that we were here in California when we moved to America, 2012. And I was teaching at Stanford and a mutual friend said, oh, I think you'd get on with her. She'd just been elected, or 2 years previously elected, AG statewide. And she'd been doing some interesting things in the view of this person as DA of San Francisco. And they thought that we'd get along. Anyway, we had this dinner. And I remember meeting 12 years ago now, but I remember liking her and thinking she was fun and interesting and impressive. And so for the longest time, I had a point of view. And I even said this on my Fox show. My audience didn't much like it when I said it, which is, you know, well, she was vice president. And I would say, look, the thing is, the reason that she's such a disaster and she speaks in this bizarre way and has all the words, all the things that we've come to know about her, the reason for that is that fundamentally, she's actually a pretty moderate Democrat, but she knows that that doesn't fly in today's Democratic Party, and you can't get anywhere if you try and have some kind of moderate or reasonable point of view. You have to go to the far left because that's where the power is. That's where the activists are. That's where the unions are, and they fund everything. And so she knows that. And so she's not really being herself. And that's why it's coming out in this bizarre way. And she can't ever say in a straight sentence, whatever. That was my line.
Yeah, the word
line.
Salad.
Right.
Yes. I want to.
But just to finish, I asked. So I would say this to people and say, no, she's really, you know, she's not stupid. She's not dumb. She's actually kind of impressive, but she doesn't know who she is, and she's a machine politician. So she goes with the flow, and she's just not being herself. And that's why.
Yeah.
And then people would say, well, why does she speak like this? She's got to be stupid. Like, it's got to be. And then the more people you talk to who know her, who worked with her, and said, no, she really is unimpressive on a fundamental level. And that's what really was revealed, even in the short campaign that we saw.
That's exactly what I think. I, I, I want to sort of agree with you, but in a slightly different way, about the pre-exposure of her.
Mm-hmm.
Because when she was exposed, I think it did. I clearly also was on the side of, I didn't realize she was that bad, that
right.
incapable of answering
right.
a question. Because in the beginning, yes, it seemed like she was almost being evasive rather than
yes.
having word salad. It was, and it's very difficult to answer questions under pressure, national, international stage, when you're trying to avoid answering the question. But I actually think she is more leftist than you think.
Yes, I
and
think that's
I'm
also,
taking that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm taking that from her first, the run for presidency, and when she ran against Biden in the primary, because she was really extolling some extreme positions then.
She was.
And I didn't think she had to at that point in time, because Biden won because he was perceived as more moderate, I believe. And
yes.
so she could have taken that, but she didn't. So I actually have a suspicion she's actually more leftist than at least what you're saying. But she was still trying to avoid answering questions. But then when she became exposed, I mean, Steve, you've been in the media. You've also been in politics in the UK at a high level position, probably dealing with a lot of media. You know, you have to be sort of smart to be able to answer the questions.
It's
and if
amazing.
You can't answer the question after 10 times of being asked the same obvious question that you're going to be asked,
yes.
then you start saying, okay, maybe she's not that smart.
No, and exactly. I mean, and the fact that she couldn't even pretend to avoid and evade the question in a remotely competent manner. I mean, let's just go back to the heart of it, which was the one day where she was in New York and she did The View. Right. And it was supposed to be an easy question. This is not a
right.
hostile interview. This is not Brett Baer on Fox or anything like that. It was Sonny Hostin, like, oh, would you check? The fact that she was so embarrassing, she sort of looked around, you know, nothing comes to mind. You know,
can't
it was
think
so
of anything.
Embarrassing. Like, not even like
this
okay.
was fully anticipatable.
Exactly.
Too. This is like, it wasn't a surprise question.
And if you want, let's just say, right, you want to be totally loyal to Biden. Let's just say that's her strategy. Right. And she's thought about it and said, look, they're going to ask me this question. I'm not going to, you know, but I have to stick to Biden because that's the only way. And if I start separating from Biden, that's a problem. You know, that's a defensible strategy. I mean, it's wrong, but you could make a case
yes.
for it. But she didn't even do that. She's not like, you know what, Sonny? I'm proud to have served with President Biden. He delivered the best, blah, 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 blah. He's a great president. We need to get behind him instead of the, you know, there's like an easy way that any kind of mildly competent politician could have answered that. Instead, it's like as if she'd never even occurred to her that someone would ask this. And she's looking around like this. Nothing comes
to mind.
You know,
I wonder, you were a consultant.
Amazing.
Right. You were a strategic advisor. You were a very high level advisor to David Cameron. I mean, where were her advisors, too? It's still her fault. I'm not saying it's not her fault, but it's still shocking that there's no one on her team.
Okay, but here's the most shocking thing. The most shocking. So that happened in, I don't know, whenever they taped that show. Is it like, I don't know, middle of the day. It's a daytime show. That evening, she went on Stephen Colbert, and it was the same. Like, she didn't have a better answer. And it wasn't quite as embarrassing, the sort of style of it. But she just still didn't have an answer. So in the intervening hours, nobody thought to say, look, we need to fix this, Madam Vice President. You've got to have... It was just unbelievably incompetent. Like
unbelievable.
So utterly inept, comically inept. And so to go back to the point about the election, I just thought... And that got worse. You know, so for the first few weeks, it was like she didn't do any interviews. And then then they panicked because obviously the polls were looking not great for them. So they said, okay, fine, let's give her lots of interviews. And the minute she does the interviews, it's like, oh yeah, we remember why she shouldn't have done interviews. And so by the end, she was looking so completely unqualified for this job. I just had this gut feeling that Americans wouldn't fall for it, that there's no way this person is going to become president. I just had a very strong view. What I didn't imagine, I really didn't imagine, was that it would be so decisive and clear and quick. You know, I was on the election night show on Fox News. I was on with in the LA bureau with Fox with Trace Gallagher, and it was just stunning. As it just became clear so quickly that, and in fact, that we were going to get the result. You know, we thought it would go on for days, maybe weeks. You know, the counting
right.
very close. That was the bit that really took me by surprise: the fact that it was so quick and so clear.
Before we get off of this Kamala Harris topic, the one thing that I feel still stunned about, and it's still going on as we end out the Biden presidency, is the cover-up of his physical and mental incompetence. And this is not about wrong policies or all this. You didn't have to be a doctor to know back in 2020 that there was a significant problem with Joe Biden.
Yes.
I happen to be a doctor. I don't make diagnoses by TV, but the reality was it was obvious then, and it became so obvious. And here's my point here. We had somebody running for president, Kamala Harris, who supposedly met with him every week, clearly knew what was going on, and she kept defending him even after the election, honestly.
Yeah.
And I find this is the greatest and most frightening cover-up in my lifetime. And I wonder, A, how she did that with a straight face. B, how the media let her get away with that.
Yes. And it's a very serious point, exactly as you say, because, I mean, it's especially from these people that lecture us endlessly about our democracy and protecting our democracy. It is very evident that the person that the people elected was not actually doing the job. There's no way he was competent to do the job. No way. And you even heard it from them. You had briefings towards the end. I think it was one of the first signs that the dam was breaking. I think Axios had the story that, he really is only operative between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. They said that. That was from inside the White House. And so you just think, this is a completely... I mean, you could say it's unconstitutional. The person that was elected is not serving as president. It's this amorphous blob. The machine was clearly running things. And yes, okay, they wheel him out to, stand in front of the podium and read out what they've written for him. I mean, it's a gross offense to every American. And you're right. And she was completely, complicit in the whole thing.
Yeah.
I mean,
not even ignoring
outrageous.
It, but actually defending it, denying it. And now, as we see in the post-election period here, it's even worse with President Biden's, mm-hmm. Lack of capacity mm-hmm. to function, not just as president, but, I think we would all have concerns if we saw our father acting like that, and we'd think he needed nursing care.
I know.
And the second part, though, is we have that's still going on. Okay, we have a post-election. It's still going on. Somehow the people ignore it. And meantime, Kamala Harris, the vice president, has been in Hawaii since the election. I'm still very frightened, despite the election, and we want to be optimistic and all this. But what is going on here as we have massive international conflicts, potential nuclear war? I mean, I don't know what your take is, and you don't speak for the UK, of course. You're a proud American citizen, of course. But you have experience in what went on at 10 Downing Street when the US-UK sort of collaborative relationship was going on. I wonder what is going on and what does the rest of the world think about what's going on?
Well, first of all, I just want to underline your point and amplify it in a way, which is that it's not just that we have these very, very scary and unstable, situations around the world. He's just massively escalated it. And you say, well, is it him or who? I mean, who made it? Just completely recklessly, changing policy after the election when he's a lame duck in respect of Ukraine and the missiles. And you can, whether or not you agree with the decision, and there are people who can make the case powerfully on both sides, it's a massive escalation. And to do that after the election, when it's obvious that he's not in charge, it's terrifying. It's really terrifying.
Well, you do have to question before you finish your answer. I have to say, it's frightening. That's why I can't say mm-hmm. nothing here mm-hmm. because he's not, I really think it's ludicrous to think that Joe Biden is running the country.
I
don't think he's
you.
Been running the country for months or perhaps years. This is shocking to me because he's not running it. Kamala Harris, the vice president, is not running it. We have this is talk about a deep state. We have anonymous people making policy decisions. I really believe that. Mm-hmm. I can't prove it, mm-hmm. but I think that's highly likely that
really
we don't know who's in charge.
You've made me think about something. I'm glad you're really, pressing on it, because you know, there's a lot of talk for, you know, about should Hunter Biden be prosecuted or Joe Biden or any other Biden family, you know, what happens after he's left office. And, you know, I've been very strong on that corruption, that family corruption. I was going on and on about it on my show, that all the different connections, it's all true. But this is in a way, I mean, in a way you say, well, that's just what happens. You know, that's just Washington corruption, the kind of pay to play and enriching your family members. You know, it's just the Bidens were a very egregious example of it. But in a way, it's not out of the ordinary. What you're talking about here is really is. And I think you're, now the more I think about it in this conversation, I think there needs to be some kind of serious investigation into what happened so that, it, you know, so that people can see that this can't happen again, that you're not right. allowed to do this, that the government can't cover up in this way for the leader, supposedly, of the most powerful nation on earth. It's just really outrageous. There needs to be a formal proceeding, I think.
I think you're right. I think this is, and again, it's not really front and center in the news, even today. It really isn't.
Yes.
People, even on the social media world, people want to have these investigations about X, Y, or Z, COVID, whatever you want to say. To me, the most important thing is still going on. And it's really a shock. This is right out of the movies. This is the days of the USSR propping up whoever it was, Andropov or Brezhnev, who had a stroke.
Yes, exactly.
I forget, you know, what that was. But these are people who are essentially, they're completely not really there mentally half the time. And I don't even understand how, again, we're seeing repeated failure of the media here, in my view.
It's
massive failure.
And you've got the, and exactly right. And I mean, the other, I mean, you had that succession of them. You had Andrei Chernenko. I always compared, I put the footage on, I found it. There's not that much footage from those years, but there's this amazing video of Konstantin Chernenko, who was the Soviet leader, who was just, you know, half dead. I mean, he could barely do anything. And they kind of staged this thing where he was pretending to vote in some fake election. And it was just so, I mean, sad, but the way he was walking and moving and shuffling was just like Biden. And and there was a really, you know, I made that comparison. It's outrageous what's happened. I'm very glad. It's true. We sort of moved on and you know, he was just in Brazil at that summit and wandering around, and we laugh at him wandering around in the jungle. It's not funny.
It's not funny. I mean, actually, but I would recommend to the viewers and to you, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Death of Stalin.
Oh, it's an amazing movie. It's amazing.
This is an amazing movie. Yes. And I think it's probably the most appropriate movie to see among all the things that, that even I saw in the White House with my analogies to Catch-22 or Kafka, all this kind of bizarre, irrational stuff, Veep. But Death of Stalin should be right up on everyone's list over the holidays.
It's a fantastic movie.
Let me say something else, which is, you know, what, you know, my thought about the media in relation to the election outcome. I mean, for me, it was, I underestimated how Americans would disregard propaganda. Mm-hmm. I think I said this. I also overestimated how many people care what's on so-called mainstream media.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to social media. And so that's sort of, I'd like your thoughts on what does it say about the importance of TV news, of mainstream media, number one. And the second part of my question is, did this kind of outrageous media coverage, where we saw the data on how negative it was about Trump, how positive it was about Harris, I wonder if they actually, in a way, caused the result?
I think that's a really big part of it. And I think that the truth has been revealed, which is that just the influence isn't there anymore. I mean, yes, in the, you know, Washington, New York kind of elite bubble, they all read the New York Times and the Washington Post and watch Morning Joe on MSNBC and listen to Morning Edition on NPR and all these things. But normal people don't. And the audiences for most of these institutions is collapsing. And even if you look at the New York Times, which can boast very big numbers in terms of its audience, the vast proportion of that, they're going there for recipes and for the quizzes and for Wordle and all this kind of stuff. That's how the New York Times has saved itself as a business. And so, and what you've seen is an explosion of media on the rebel side, as I like to think of it. And it's not just, I mean, of course, you've got to say, Elon Musk buying X was a transformative moment. So that we know that there's a platform for free
yes,
speech.
Yes, absolutely.
And then for the alternative media to get the word out and to be promoted. So you've got the massive scale now of shows like Tucker Carlson and Megyn Kelly and Dan Bongino, people doing incredibly well on the new platforms. That's where the audience is. The scale vastly dominates anything in the traditional media. So I funnily enough, I'm asked this question a lot when I'm on the road and so on, and speaking to audiences, how can we win with the media against us? It's already happening. You know, the media is just going to be less and less of a gatekeeper, except for themselves, for the elite. And so that's why they're all kind of stranded on this island of nonsense, while people are just enjoying a massive diversity of a real true diversity of views through all these other platforms.
I mean, there's no doubt that the media, it's undermined itself, its own credibility. I mean, the trust has plummeted in all of our institutions for a variety of reasons, particularly what was exposed during COVID. But, you know, beyond that, a lot of things happened. But this is the best example of all where the media caused its self-destruction. And I just wonder what the future is of TV news, really, of the newspapers. You know, people have been talking about how social media will sort of take over. And at first, I believed it, but then I was watching astounded that social media became a way to actually censor the public dialogue. Once everyone sort of started depending on it, then they were distorting it with the Twitter, Facebook, YouTube type of censorship. And then, of course, the transformation was we have a billionaire who bought it, who cares about free speech. And this was really shocking, but in such a positive way.
But you just got to look at the numbers. It's a bit, you know, it's a business. And if you look at what's going on, I mean, Fox News is doing very well. The CNN and MSNBC are collapsing. And that shows there's an appetite for well-produced news that isn't, you know, pushing the groupthink. And then all these other shows and, you know, radio, there's real energy in the media. And so I think some of these businesses, I mean, look at what's just happened with Comcast spinning off MSNBC, its other cable channels. They know that it's a disastrous business. So that, you know, that's on the way out. CNN, the new CEO of CNN, who I know is a very accomplished guy, Mark Thompson, a British guy who was at the BBC. He knows that there's no future for them. They're focused on online and the website and trying to get and you can go back to news.
It's still interesting. It is still interesting, though, that when you travel internationally and in the airports and things, you know, the Europe, in my impression, is they get their U.S. news mainly from CNN. It's in all the hotels. It's in, you know, I'm not talking about the people who use social media, but in terms of TV, they don't know anything about Fox News, for instance. They get their stuff through CNN, and then they have their BBC and Sky News. But, you know, I wonder what the future... That's an opportunity, I feel. I actually don't think that TV news is dead. It's only dying because it's so outrageously biased and it doesn't seek the truth. I think a lot of us still like to watch... You know, at night, you know, I don't think everything should be, you know, it's so thrilling to be on Twitter constantly. But I do think there's an opportunity.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree.
But we'll see what happens.
I agree.
Yeah. So what do you think? Let's talk a little bit about, you know, free speech and the real issues here. You know, again, you've pointed out the obvious and I agree, which is really thank God Elon Musk bought Twitter and it restored the essential freedom of all. And you're someone who has a unique background. I mentioned in the intro, you know, your parents escaped the communist regime, and you have come to the U.S. as a eager to participate in a country that had such opportunity and freedoms guaranteed, like no other, really.
Yes.
And I wonder what your thoughts are on what you've seen with the censorship and you know, what's your impression now?
It's an amazing development. I mean, you know, even that we've been here 12 years, I've been a citizen 3.5 years, and it's just incredible. And I do think it seems to have been connected to the sort of twin factors of Trump and COVID. Because that's really when I think this has all just got going, this censorship. There's an amazing story that comes to mind when you ask that question, actually, which is that, so I grew up in the UK. My parents are both Hungarian. My stepfather's Hungarian. Everyone's Hungarian. And all my family is in, and still is, in Hungary. And when I was younger, we would go back to Hungary every year, at least once a year, often twice, always in the summer, often at Christmas time as well, to spend time with family. I remember, and we're from a town in the south of Hungary, a beautiful town on the border with, what is it now, Slovenia, Serbia, called Szeged is the town. And I remember, I mean, I don't know, must have been 10 or 11 years old, something like that. But I really remember this. I was walking around the town with my, I have two cousins, and I was walking around and I remember shouting. I mean, you know, why was I doing this? Maybe it's a sort of hint of things to come. I was shouting, the guy who was leading, is the communist leader of Hungary at that time, called János Kádár, K-A-D-A-R, Kádár. And I said, Kádár egy hülye, I speak Hungarian. I said, Kádár egy hülye, hülye, whatever. Hülye means idiot. So I was just saying, Kádár's an idiot, you know, something like that, in the street. And I didn't think much of it. Anyway, that evening, my aunt, who was then the I think either the head teacher or the deputy head teacher, you know, senior role at the local school, the high school, she took me to one side and she said, look, I know in England you can say that kind of thing and it's funny and it's not a big deal, but here you really can't. Your cousins could really get in trouble. I could actually lose my job. You just can't say things like that on the street. And I always remembered it because it was so striking. But I hadn't really processed, I didn't think about it very much until the last few years. And that is what is happening here in America today. Like that was a communist country in the 1970s. People here today actually lose their jobs because of what they say. That's real. And many more are fearful of saying what they think because it might cost them their jobs. It's just amazing that that is happening here in America.
And I think the people that are most amazed in a funny way are people like you who have a history, have a personal history with countries like that. This is why people came to the U.S.
Yes.
I think a great number, a percentage of people who came to the U.S. were escaping regimes like that. They came for, of course, personal opportunity, but also for the freedoms that this country, this is the beacon of freedom for the world. To me, there's no question about that. And people came here specifically to escape that sort of thing. And then I think COVID really exposed everything. Mm-hmm. The pandemic, I'd like to hear your thought on that. I mean, I always say, I don't think COVID really in the pandemic itself caused these things. I think they were always there, but we didn't realize it. Mm-hmm. And it sort of gave the opportunity to impose in a very explicit, overt way these restrictions, I always wondered, for instance, when I was a kid watching the three news networks, was I being propagandized at the time? I just didn't know it. I mean, yes. I wonder what you think. Is this a new thing in history here, or was this sort of there and we weren't aware?
No, I think the censorship is new. I really do. I mean, especially here. I mean, back in the day in England, you know, whether you don't have the First Amendment and there are debates about these things. And I remember the kinds of debates that would happen in England were pretty mild in this space. You know, for example, there was a big controversy over a blasphemy bill, right? Where driven by concerns about Islamophobia, you know, like the satanic verses and Salman Rushdie and all that kind of thing. Should there be a law against blasphemy and criminal penalties if you introduce a religion and so on, and you had comedians, you know, saying this is outrageous, you know, actually taking quite tough positions, saying no, you can't. This is Rowan Atkinson, a very famous comedian, big champion of free speech. So you know, those are the kind of debates you had. But the concept
that was
of,
Mr. Bean, wasn't
Mr.
it?
Mr. Bean, exactly.
Yes.
And so, you know, you had these debates, but the fact that in America, it's not even debated. You just had this assumption that you can shut down speech because the authorities deemed it to be, you know, misinformation, disinformation, all the sort of bullshit language they use, the, you know, danger, putting people's lives at risk. It's all just, and of course they were wrong. I mean, you know, as you and I, and you know better than anyone, you know, pretty much everything they said was true turned out to be misinformation, and everything they said was misinformation turned out to be true. And so it's truly stunning. And I have a really, but it's also, the whole thing was, I'm going to curse again. It was bullshit because I had a really brilliant example of it in about how ridiculous and completely untethered from reality it was. It was just all ideology and groupthink, which was on my show when the vaccine mandates. The vaccine was out. This is the COVID era, and Jay Bhattacharya, our mutual friend at Stanford, right, was very strong against vaccine mandates. So he was not anti-vax. He just said, look, the COVID vaccine does not prevent transmission. It was never designed to prevent transmission. The emergency use authorization doesn't even talk about preventing transmission. It's a private benefit, not a public benefit. It protects right. you, it doesn't protect anyone else. There is no case for a vaccine mandate. And,
right,
and yet people are losing their jobs because they, you know, et cetera. So I had Jay on my podcast to talk about that. And we put it up on YouTube. And YouTube took it down and censored it on the grounds of contradicts our whatever community
contradicts
health,
CDC
blah blah
yeah.
blah right
exactly.
And so this was, I remember it so clearly, the timeline is what's so interesting, and I immediately thought, well, this is hilarious and ridiculous, and I immediately said to my team, let's have Jay on my Fox News show where we won't be censored and we can talk about both the censorship and the point about vaccine mandates, and we're going to lead the show with it. I'm going to rail against YouTube and it's going to be fun. And so we did two things at the same time. So my social media, my team who produced the podcast put in an objection to the a complaint through YouTube, through its normal processes, to say, you know, this is wrong. We dispute this. This is totally fair and comment, and it's you're wrong and you should put it back up. And at the same time, my Fox News team in New York reached out to their communications people to have to say, look, we're going to be doing this. Do you want to put someone up to defend it? Almost at the same time, we had a message back from YouTube through the normal channel that said, we have carefully reviewed your content and can confirm that it contradicts our community guide and therefore we cannot reinstate it, blah, blah, blah. Almost at the same time, they emailed my team in New York, said, we're really sorry about this. This was taken down in error and we will make sure it's back up and we're terribly sorry about it. And I just think, like, it's bullshit. It's all bullshit.
Right. Well, you know, I have a similar story. I gave a talk, an invited talk at University of Colorado in Boulder, and went through just data after data slide. And it was posted by University of Colorado on YouTube, and YouTube took it down and blocked it and said it's against policy. And I called in the same kind of thing. The university called YouTube. YouTube claimed it was an error. And, you know, it should have never been taken down. So you have to wonder, and I actually believe that it's actually not necessarily coming from the top. I'm not trying to
Yes.
give the top people an excuse. I just believe that these companies are, in a funny way, infiltrated
Mm-hmm.
by these independent, I'm going to call them warriors.
Mm-hmm.
They take it upon themselves to pull things down. I don't think that people like, you know, Zuckerberg or Elon Musk or anybody is busy looking at specific
that's
things.
Right.
Of course, that's ludicrous. And I think I'm not giving them a pass. I'm just saying, I think a lot of this stuff is done by individuals, perhaps the same people who are running the presidency of the United States as we speak.
Yeah. And also, I bet you a lot of it is automated as well. So they'll have, you know, words that they've, you know, there's so many things uploaded the whole time. No human can watch it all. So they'll have code words that sort of immediately flag the content. You talk about the vaccine, okay, danger. Yeah, so they'll,
right,
they'll,
exactly.
then they'll look at it, you know, and just the whole thing is, and the presumption is, but this is the big thing that's changed, is the entire presumption upon which America is built, which is that you have the right, the default is you can say it. And it seems to be with these people, their default, which they use this euphemism of safety, right? Safety is that you can't say it. The default is you can only say what we allow you to say. We must protect you from things that are dead. And all this language that they use to describe speech, and, you know, it goes right back to the universities and the microaggressions and safe spaces, safe from speech, not physical
right.
violence, but speech and safety and protection and all this kind of stuff. Like, you can't be offended. I mean, that is so antithetical to everything, not just literally to the law, to the Constitution, but to the idea of America.
And I think it's harmful, particularly the university environment. you know, these are professors at our so-called elite universities, and I think that's a misnomer, but we'll keep that word for this, is that they're teaching this kind of behavior to our students, to our children, to the next generation who's going to lead this country in most of the leadership roles, really. And that is very harmful, to think that that character assassination, any cancel culture, censorship is the way to go, mm-hmm. instead of actually allowing the free exchange of ideas, because you can't figure out what's true. This shouldn't even need to be said.
I know.
But if you can't learn critical, you cannot learn critical thinking without hearing differing views. I mean, this is sort of obvious.
Yeah, but here's the good news. Like, and you saw it going back to the election. I mean, look at what happened. Look, in terms of the youth vote. I mean, Trump won the youth vote amongst, I think it was men, and very close amongst women. So overall, I think this was the number, that it was Biden plus 20 in 2020 amongst young people, 18 to 24 or whatever the category is. And now it was plus two, or was it plus two,
yeah,
Trump? I can't remember.
Yeah,
huge,
it was
change.
Something, there was an extraordinary shift, and that was surprising and a hugely positive sign. You know, I wonder, extrapolating from the U.S. to what we're seeing with free speech, particularly in your former, home, mm-hmm. The U.K., this is very frightening. I mean, you know, you can't, I'm shocked at what's going on. I think everyone's shocked at what's going on there, where they're saying you can be arrested. It's not just taking down what you post on social media.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
This is a cause for this is a crime there now.
It's unbelievable.
Well, what's going on? What's your take on this? And will this last, or will this election here have a ramification?
No, I don't
really
think the election here will make any difference. They've just had an election there, of course, and they've got this new Labour government. And I think that, I mean, I don't follow it closely, but I've just seen a couple of these stories pop up. And it's terror. And you see the videos of people being arrested. You know, they're going, the police going to their home in the middle of the night, banging on the door, going back to the communist thing. Literally, the knock on the door in the night. That's what's happening. It is completely outrageous. There's someone I actually know personally who's a fantastic opinion journalist. She writes a column, Alison Pearson. I mean, probably most people watching, listening to us won't have come across her. She's a long-standing, I would say, sort of common sense conservative. She's written for the Daily Mail, the Daily Telegraph. I'm not sure where she is now. I always got along with her. Great. She's just a really fantastic, you know, part of the landscape in terms of media opinion. She's an opinion writer. She had the police. She wasn't arrested, but they threatened her. They came to her house. And then when she publicized it, they threatened her and said that she was putting them at risk by publicizing it.
Yes.
And you just think,
it's very
frightening.
Yeah, the power of the government. First, it's outrageous and insane and all of this kind of stuff. But then you have to realize the people in charge, they have power. It's frightening. And I'm sure that it's, it's not easy to be the person who's attacked by your government. I feel like this is something that we really can't lose sight of. Mm-hmm. Because there are human beings involved here. We need to keep the pressure on. We can't just say, okay, on to the next issue. I feel like this is really out of hand. I'm worried about the UK. I travel a lot. They're really out of control, what's going on over there.
But then you've got another, you know, let's again remind ourselves of the good news that she's able, just in that particular case, to publicize all this on Twitter now.
Right.
And you can tell everyone what's going on and post videos and what. And so that's it. It's an amazing thing that Elon did. I mean, it really, really is.
No, you can't underestimate it. I mean, he's the most important figure in my lifetime, I'll say. Unfortunately, we're a society that depends on billionaires too much. Fortunately, that's one that has done some incredible things for humanity there. Thanks for joining us for part one of my conversation with Steve Hilton. We'll be back to continue our conversation about what he sees next in the media in the United States and in California in particular. So stay tuned.